You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
The criteria on the show are basically that we want people to tell something that's truly interesting, that we don't know, that's, you know, novel, that's not widely known, and that's worthwhile, that's worth knowing. In other words, not just some base, some random trivia.
Wait, tell me that again, interesting?
Well, let's see, interesting...
Worthwhile,
and not widely known.
Not widely known.
You know, novel and true, by the way.
Can I suggest that this is almost advice in general? Like, if you have a job of any sort, like accountant or alligator breeder or astronaut, go through this exercise of thinking of things you know that have these three qualities: interesting, worthwhile, not widely known.
One of the attributes that many, let's call them business successes, have, people who are very successful in their careers, maybe not business per se, is that they have a real pronounced ability and appetite for self-examination, which sounds like, well, of course you have to, you know, look at how you're doing. But, you know, I find that many, many, many people I know don't do that.
What's the skill of, how do you get the skill of self-examination? Like, break that down into its components. So this is like, I feel like this is a reunion podcast. Like, we shut down, question of the day. What has it been like? Our last one was like a month or two ago.
Probably 2 months.
2 months. I lose track of time. We've certainly gotten together since then, but we haven't done question of the day. By the way, I was at a Quora meetup, and so many people there said, oh, question of the day. But I just said it's on hiatus for now. Well, we'll see. But that's not what this podcast is about.
Somebody tweeted the other day. We were, we had tweeted about this new podcast that you and I are going to talk about a little bit today, and that we're launching it like now.
I just want to mention, it's a brand new type of format I've never seen in a podcast before, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's a revolution, a podcast revolution. But we had tweeted about Tell Me Something I Don't Know, the new one, and that it was launching, and a question of the day follower wrote to say, are you going to discontinue this in a year and break my heart again? And I wrote back, because I thought it was an interesting question. I wrote back to say, but what about the old, I think it was Tennyson who said, isn't it, you know, 'tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And I think most people don't believe that. I think most people think it is better to have never loved at all than to have loved and lost. Well, and I'm not saying that the heartbreak from QOD, question of the day, is so severe that it's like, no, a breakup, but
well, a lot of people miss it, but I think the interesting thing is that podcasting is a, just like television was, just like radio, just like any medium or any communications medium, is developing and inventing itself as it happens. And I think experiments in the format are always worthwhile, and that's what we did with Question of the Day. We experimented with a different type of format than the, you know, there's 60,000 interview podcasts, including this one. And then there was other ones like Question of the Day or, you know, other podcasts that we've seen, like Serial and stuff like that. And now you're experimenting with a new one. But I think that's the nature of the beast, that there's a new creative medium that comes out and people experiment. And
it's also a lot cheaper. I mean, if you compare audio to video, it's orders of magnitude. Video has gotten cheaper, but it's still... it's just so much more involved, you know, to make a 5-minute film or video And so like, yeah, audio, because it's like more two dimensional or whatever, cheaper, easier, you can experiment. Also, you know, like, because it's cheaper, you can do it yourself and you're not reliant on some gigantic media overlord giving you permission to make it.
Right. Like, it just takes recording, in the worst case, recording, making a homemade studio with GarageBand, or go into a studio for a cheap amount per hour and record a couple episodes, and then you just upload to iTunes.
Right, and not only that.
You have a show. You have your own show.
But, like, think about the distribution and the ease and cost. So, like, you know, we may have talked about this before. Forgive me if we did, but, you know, when I was writing journalism for the New York Times back in the day when the primary way of people getting it was on paper, right? Even though we went digital at the Times pretty early. So if I wanted to write a magazine piece for the New York Times Magazine, first I had the gatekeepers within, right, the editors at the big media organization. But then additionally, the cost of manufacturing and distribution were massive. So there were all the people who ran the printing presses. There was the physical cost of the printing presses themselves and all the labor, all the real estate. Everything associated with that. And then distribution, literally the New York Times, not that long ago, used to own fleets of trucks to deliver their thing. Now you press a button and iTunes and the other distributors give it to everyone in the world who wants it instantly for free. I mean, right. the advantages now are just...
And of course, this has happened with books. You don't need to go through...
What's a book?
You don't need to go through an agent, editor, publisher, marketing team, bookstore purchaser. Those were all the people in the middle between you and the reader. So you don't need to go through any of that with publishing a book. With TV, not only are there more formats like Amazon, Hulu, Netflix that are buying original programming, but you can also just upload directly to YouTube. Same thing with music, where there have been many breakout artists on these things. Now, podcasts, there's a lot of podcasts out there, but again, like any medium, there's lots of TV shows out there, there's lots of books out there. Yes, there are a lot of podcasts out there, and the best ones will rise to the top, and you experiment to see. But the other thing I want to point out about question of the day is that we did the experiment, and it's not like it failed. I mean, we were doing pretty good, and we had a nice distribution and people listening, and but the experiment kind of ran itself out. Like, we were having trouble coming up with I would say, from my point of view, being excited about brand new shows.
Yeah, in my view, the main reason to stop was that because of the nature of the show, it was not an interview show. It was not a researched journalism show, which is more like Freakonomics Radio, where every week you take a new topic and you do a crap load of research. It was not a format like a game show, which is what my new show is. So basically, it was the two of us having conversations. And even though we are pretty good at having conversations, it's not like an infinite pool of stuff.
We get
to
bored
say.
Of each other.
Well, I didn't get bored of you, but I felt like I was like, I needed to find out more stuff. I needed to learn more stuff or do more research or, you know.
Well, one thing I learned from you and from Freakonomics Radio, and comparing Freakonomics Radio, Serial, you know, other shows at that level with, let's say, even the best or the top ranked interview shows, which I'll throw mine in that tier roughly. Your Freakonomics Radio is highly, and Serial and Startup are highly, highly produced. There's like, you have a team of people, you're doing tons of research, you're bringing on several guests, you're editing segments pretty heavily. There's a lot of work that goes into every hour of production.
Yeah, you want me to show you a script? Here, I'll show you.
You're going to show me a script of Freakonomics Radio. And I will say, the higher level of production quality, that simply translates into more downloads. Like, I've seen that across the board.
Well, we think it does.
I mean, it
may be that there are a lot of highly produced shows that you don't know about.
But I look at the rankings, yeah. And I see. It's a pretty roughly direct correlation between highly produced shows and downloads. You know, you had a brand with Freakonomics,
yeah.
But you would have lost that in the podcasting world, like many people do, if you didn't have a highly produced show.
Right. So this is a script of the first episode in a series of three parts called Bad Medicine.
So I'm holding this, and it's like 40 pages, and it's typewritten, but then there's hundreds and hundreds of notes written all over this. I'm thumbing through it right now, and it's crazy. Like, I would never think to do this much research, but this is, again, you know, you have a huge number of downloads per episode, and that's why you're probably the top one or two podcasts in the world, actually.
I think I'm not actually sure, because the data on actual the actual data on downloads are assembled by various people in different ways, but I know that we're up there. Yeah, so we do okay.
So just to reiterate, I'm with Stephen Dubner, author or co-author of Freakonomics, along with Stephen Levitt. We've had you on the James Altucher Show, I think 4 times.
Really?
Yeah.
Does that put me in the top tier, okay, or not quite?
You were on in the I interviewed you in the first week of starting.
For the swimsuit issue, I think that was, right?
Yeah, exactly. The Freakonomics swimsuit issue, which was really freaky. And then you came on with How to Rob a Bank, and you came on with How to Think Like a Freak. You might have come on when we introduced Question of the Day. So this is either the third or the fourth time. But now you have a brand new podcast, which has a very fascinating format for podcasts. It's almost like a TV show style format. It's called Tell Me Something I Don't Know. Why don't you describe it to me? Because honestly, I know it's just beginning. Your description, I think, for the podcast needs a little work. So describe it. Pitch it to me,
all right,
the show, and then let's discuss it. Because it's actually, I listened to the first pilot episode, which is not coming out till Monday, which is probably the day before this podcast is being released. But anyway, it's a great show. I highly recommend it once it comes out. And I learned something from the show. But why don't you pitch it to me?
So we should say that I'm the world's worst pitcher.
You're going to get a little better right now,
the show. Probably not. So my problem is... I know that the way you should pitch something, typically what most pitches are it's X meets Y with a slash of Z. And that's just kind of not the way. I actually actively try to think the opposite of that way, because I would rather try to be, quote, original or, quote, creative, even though I think it's almost impossible to actually be original because, you know, you live in the world and things swim around. But I would rather be bad and do kind of what feels to me organic or original than to come up with like an awesome clone.
So, but let me ask you about that. So just to summarize what you said, mm-hmm. Rather than say this is, you know, sharks meet tornadoes and we create Sharknado.
Wait, why do you say NATO but then NATO? Sharks meet tornadoes and then Sharknado?
Isn't that what the movie, how they pronounce the movie?
I don't know. Does that make sense? Wouldn't it be Sharknado?
Sharknado?
Sharknado? It's like you say Soprano, I say Soprano.
Okay.
Tomato, tomato.
So rather than coming up with just some derivative thing, sharks meet tornadoes.
I'll touch her.
Yeah, exactly. rather than doing some derivative thing where you say, I don't know another derivative thing now, but sharks meet tornado equals Sharknado. You're gonna say, I'm gonna come up with something so original, it's not gonna be explainable. But
because that makes me sound even more pretentious than I sounded, which I apologize.
But I wanna bring it back to what Steven Johnson always refers to, that the best ideas that people accept come out of what he calls the adjacent possible.
Yeah.
So that we see something that we're comfortable with, we add to it, and that becomes creativity.
Totally.
And so people who separate too far from that, they end up getting banished until they're ahead of their time. And they end up getting banished, like the guy who suggested
Semmelweis.
Washing his hands before treating patients. He was like died at a mental institution or something until they accepted it as common practice. So are you kind of going so far away from the adjacent possible? Because I think with Tell Me Something I Don't Know, which is the name of your new show, you could kind of do an X meets Y.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure you could.
Let's do it.
Well, I guess it would be standard journalism meets game show meets sit-down comedy. Because it's not stand-up comedy where someone has the floor for a long time, but it's more like repartee of a panel who are sitting down.
Okay, so that's a little like Hollywood, the old Hollywood Square show.
I'll take Hollywood Square.
Like sit-down comedy. I'm going to say maybe it's like – it definitely has a game show format.
Yeah.
So it's game show meets – I don't know, Ripley's Believe It or Not, or something like that.
Right, which is what I think of as journalism. Right, okay, so all right, now I'll explain it. So I'm not good at pitching, but I'll explain it. So basically, I've been a journalist really since I was a kid. We had a family newspaper, and then I was always trying to freelance and string even when I was a kid. And the thing that I liked about journalism is that it gave you permission to ask questions and to be nosy and curious, and that was really important for me because as a kid, I was really, really, really shy. And so when I first started out as a reporter, even though I was technically a reporter, even if it was for like the school paper, you know, to go up to someone and say, you know, I'm writing about blah, blah, blah for the paper. Can I ask you a few questions? Even that was hard with the notebook. And so it would have been impossible without the notebook. So the notebook for me was always a little bit of a coping mechanism. And then, you know, you get better.
By the way, that's an excellent technique for anyone.
I agree. Even if you just say, you know, I'm writing a blog, I'm writing a newsletter, you know, I'm curious to know.
Or a photographer, you have a great look, I'd love to take a photograph.
Yeah. And I think, you know, being a photographer who shoots people takes unbelievable, you know, not just courage, but a kind of ability to, like my wife, who was a really great photographer, she doesn't do it anymore. And she did kind of very intense, often foreign, you know, she was overseas a lot. She did documentary journalism. But like the intensity and the intimacy, like you need to get in people's lives for often weeks or months and in their faces. And like, right, that's very hard. It's really hard for many people, certainly me. So anyway, I've been doing some form of journalism, many different forms for a while. And one question that I found that is really useful. Yeah, so one of the things that I realized I was doing a lot as a journalist. So, you know, if you're a writer or a journalist, you try hard to learn about the world, obviously, that's what you're doing, and you try hard certainly to prepare for people when you interview them. But the nature of it is that...
By the way, do you think that's changed? Sorry to interrupt. Do you think that's changed in the past 20 years? I feel like journalists now, A, wait for the calls to come to them, and B, are more about what's sensationalist because they're so desperate for page views so their company stays in business.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I think a lot of the emphasis on how sensational or narrow or shallow whatever journalism is, I think a lot of that is silly. I think if you go back 100 years ago, overall the journalism was much worse on most dimensions. It's cyclical, B, it's human nature, but C, sex and crime, et cetera, have always sold and
but I feel like I feel like there was a golden age of journalism after Watergate, after all the president's men glorified, you know, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein.
It is certainly true that there was a period in American journalism where the let's say the median caliber was higher. But also, that's very much related to the economics of it. So journalism, newspapers particularly, you know, newspapers had a monopoly. They had a variety of monopolies that they didn't even know they had. But basically, if you ran a newspaper in a city, you pretty much owned all the advertising for every job that anyone was offering, for every car that anyone was selling, for any house anyone was selling or renting, and so on. And they didn't really appreciate how unbelievably lucky they were. But that money funded journalism, which in turn they could afford to go deep and broad. And then when they lost that monopoly, when the digital revolution began to happen, you know, then all of a sudden they're like, oh, my God, we need to think of how to do this differently with a lot less fewer resources. But I don't know if – look, I think you can be a really, 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 really good journalist – with very few resources other than your brain. I mean, that's really what it's always been boiled down to. So do I think that the quality overall of journalism has declined a little bit in the last 20 years? Probably. There's probably less good journalism and more bad, but I don't think it's hugely different now than any time it's been in modern history.
Okay.
I mean, look, I'm not a press scholar. I know press scholars. We could talk to them about. But I found that... So I try to prepare and I try to, you know, ask good questions of the people that I'm talking to. But I realized that one of the best questions you could often ask, and especially this was if something came up impromptu, you met someone on an airplane, right, and they do something interesting, or you're at a conference or a party and people do something interesting, like you want to know about it, you want to know about what they do, but you literally don't have the ammunition, you don't have the knowledge to ask a quote smart question. Plus, I don't really care about seeming smart because I think that's overvalued, and I'd rather be honest. I'd rather, you know, act like I'm a relatively bright ninth grader. I'm curious, I want to know what you have to tell me, but I don't know how to get that from you. So I came up with this formulation just over time. It was basically, hey, tell me something, you know, if I meet you on a plane and you tell me that you are, you know, an alligator breeder or that you are, you know, a software developer, whatever, I would say, hey, tell me something I don't know about writing software. Tell me something I don't know about breeding alligators. And I found that that phrase was just kind of like this magic key that people would take it as a kind of fun challenge. Like, okay, I'm going to assume that you, the person who's asking the question, are not a complete idiot. So you know what alligators are, you know what software is. So yeah, let's see, you want me to tell you something you don't know about that? Okay. And inevitably I would find that that was what they came up with was like so interesting. And so that was the inspiration for this new show, which I called Tell Me Something I Don't Know, which I've been thinking about literally for like 5 years. It took 5 years to get it from like—
Well, that is interesting. So let's try that out right now. And then finally we'll get to the description of the show and the details of the show and how interesting it is, and we'll learn some other things I don't know from the actual contents of the show. But on question of the day, we were always talking about golf. I know nothing about golf. You're a golfer. Tell me something I don't know now about golf after having hundreds of conversations with you already about golf.
Sure, yeah. So
it has to be something that's like quirky too, right? So I would be interested. There's lots of things I don't know about golf, which is like the average yardage per hole. I don't know about golf, but that's not so interesting to me.
Right. So you want me to think of the best, kind of the most interesting thing that I think you may not know about golf.
And it could be history. It could be the bios of golfers.
I know a fair amount about golf, although so this is where it's right. And this is why, by the way, even though our show, Tell Me Something I Don't Know, is live, this is why we solicit people, contestants, way ahead of time and make sure and basically, like, for every 20 or for every one person that we bring up on stage to tell us something fascinating, there are probably 30 or 40 that we talk to, but we don't feel like they have something really that interesting.
It's got to be the most interesting for prime time, essentially.
Yeah, not even for prime time, just like truly interesting. Like, the criteria on the show are basically that we want people to tell us something that's truly interesting, that we don't know, that's, you know, novel, that's not widely known, and that's worthwhile, that's worth knowing. In other words, not just some random trivia.
Wait, tell me that again. Interesting?
Well, let's see. Interesting.
Worthwhile.
Worthwhile. And not widely known.
Not widely known.
Novel. And true, by the way.
Can I suggest that this is almost advice in general? Like, if you have a job of any sort, like accountant or alligator breeder or astronaut, go through this exercise of thinking of things you know that have these three qualities: interesting, worthwhile, not widely known. So it could turn you also into a better conversationalist. These are ways to translate what I do into something exciting to other people. Can I tell you something I didn't know about golf until you told me that I thought was incredibly fascinating, and I've repeated it to several other people, even though I am bored to tears about golf, which is that to be a better golf player, the one thing you can do to guarantee you'll be better from one day to the next is, and I didn't know this, is improve leg strength.
Yeah, well, that's something I learned literally from asking the question, tell me something I don't know. That was, so this is a guy that you and I have talked about a good bit before. His name is Anders Ericsson. He's a psychologist by training. Actually, he was a nuclear engineer originally by training, then psychology. And he's one of the people who kind of formed the school of research about expert performance, from which the 10,000 hour rule came out of, et cetera, et cetera. And Anders, who I've known for a while over the years and whose work I love, I was at an event. I was at Florida State University where he teaches, and I was there to give a talk. And it was during dinner before the talk, and I hadn't known Anders was going to be there, and I was delighted. And they knew that we knew each other, so they sat us at the same table, which was great. So we chatted, we caught up, and I said, you know, Anders, since the last time I saw you, I've become a golf nut, and I'm doing okay. I'm improving. I'm working really hard, improving a little, but I really could use, you know, a cheat sheet, you know, some advantage.
He's basically the master of the cheat sheets.
Exactly.
Because everybody calls him, like Josh Foer, who's been on my podcast, when he was becoming the U.S. memory champion. Right. Who does he call? Anders Ericsson.
Well, Anders is uniquely situated to talk about memory, because memory was his first research project with this amazing thing, I think with Herb Simon at Carnegie Mellon, where they taught this random guy to memorize up to 30-some, 50-some, 80-some digits.
200 digits.
It's an amazing story.
When the record was like 50.
Yeah, it's remarkable. So I said to Anders, you know, tell me something I don't know about, you know, golfers. Have you worked with enough golfers to know, is there some overlooked skill or attribute or something to practice that would help make me better? And he said, yeah, you should work on your leg strength. And I said, why? What's that have to do? He said, well, with putting, so putting, for those of you who don't know golf at all, although I'm sure everybody knows putting because you go to miniature golf or putting green, putting is basically really important because even if you hit the ball far and straight down the course, you ultimately have to put it in the 4-foot, 4-inch hole. And that's hard. And a lot of people who are relatively good at hitting far and straight are not very good at putting, but one putt counts as much on your score as one long shot. So, and you're trying to get the lowest number of strokes per hole. So good putters, you could, if you're a great putter and an okay golfer, you can be a very, very, very good golfer. If you're a great striker of the ball and a really crappy putter, you're never going to be very good. So he said that when studying good golfers, when they putt, one thing that they had in common was that they're very, very, very firm and steady over the ball, meaning no motion, no swaying, whatever. And therefore, that translates, that arrives from leg strength and working out, and that translates into a sure hand when you're putting. And therefore, if you're going to work on, if you're going to go to the gym or do some kind of exercise as a golfer, that one thing that you could easily not think about, but you'd be wise to not overlook, would be working on your legs. So ever since then, if I go to the gym, I definitely spend a lot more time on my leg strength than I would have.
Because I would think arm strength, because you want to be able to hit like 200 yards.
So that is a very common misconception. So first of all, physical strength doesn't correlate very well with hitting the ball far in golf, which is weird if you think about it. Because you would think if you take two people who are equally skilled at the golf swing, and one of them outweighs the other by 100 pounds, that one will hit it further. But I don't think it's very logarithmic. And additionally, there are a lot of smaller people who hit it a lot further than a lot of big people. So it's true that most pro golfers have gotten bigger over the last generation or two, inspired by Tiger Woods. A lot of athletes who are great athletes who might have gone into football, soccer, baseball, basketball, whatever, some of them went into golf. But additionally, you know, it's just the general trend. But there are still Rory McIlroy, one of the best golfers in the world, is relatively shrimpy, although he works out a lot now. Ricky Fowler, one of the best golfers in the world, is, you know, you could probably wrestle him pretty easily.
But the
golf swing is much more about physics and strength, and the strength, the correlate for distance comes from your bottom half, comes from your hips. Comes from your legs. It comes basically from the ground up. Most amateurs, however, when you see the swing, it looks like, oh, you're just standing there and you're swinging your arms really hard. And that's why most amateur golfers aren't very good, is because when you do that, you don't hit it very far because you're ignoring the big muscles, and B, you're inconsistent because it's very hard to hit it straight.
Well, I love little cheats like that. I just think it's fascinating.
You know, you and I, okay, so maybe if we don't resume question of the day, or even if we do.
Cheat of the day.
No, well, cheat of the day would be good. We should make a mini podcast series about me taking you to learn golf for a few hours. And just see, like, I think you're the kind of learner, like, even if you hated it and felt that you had no aptitude or interest in it, I think you're the kind of learner that you'd be fascinated by. And see, here's what's cool about golf. This is my favorite thing about golf, is that it's one of the few things you can do in life that I know of where the feedback loop is so tight and almost perfect. And what I mean by that is, if I'm practicing, I can try. So, you know, in life, if you think, well, why am I not successful, or why am I not popular, or how could I be more X or Y or Z? You might try to change one or two things. I might try to sleep more. I might try to brush my teeth more often. I might try to work harder, whatever. But the tricky part is isolating that variable, right? Because there are all these other variables, many of which you can't control. With a golf swing, you're controlling all the variables, you know, in a given, let's say, hour. If the weather is warm, the wind is not blowing, whatever. If all that is static, the only variable is what you're doing. So you can control all those. And even though there are a lot of moving parts in the golf swing, if you try to make one slight adjustment, you can really note the change that has because the feedback is immediate because you see what the ball does.
So you're saying it's a good environment to learn how to learn.
Exactly. And here's my favorite thing about golf, as weird as this sounds. Well, this is not true. It's one of my favorite things because I just love to play. But one of my other favorite things is that it is an awesome kind of laboratory or mirror of the real world. Not only the emotional stuff, like dealing with failure and all that stuff, which is obvious, but applying how you learn and get better to other things and being extremely self-aware, while also somehow magically not being so self-aware that you cripple yourself. And to me, that's how we all try to live our lives. We need to be able to be, and you know, Angela Duckworth, who wrote Grit, that you may have talked to, did you interview her?
No, but she's definitely on my list. I mean, I love the book.
So she, I think, is remarkable, and she's very much like Anders Ericsson in a certain way. So she said that one of the attributes that many, let's call them business successes have, people who are very successful in their careers, maybe not business per se, is that they have a real pronounced ability and appetite for self-examination, which sounds like, well, of course you have to, you know, look at how you're doing. But, you know, I find that many, many, many people I know don't do that.
What's the skill of, how do you get the skill of self-examination? Like, break that down into its components.
I think a lot of it for me, I mean, I can do it for me probably better than for other people, is to look back, first of all, you have to really take time.
There's a cognitive bias against self-examination.
Is that true?
Yeah, like you don't, people don't, it is a cliche, you don't think your shit smells.
Mm. Right, well, so for me, part of it is, you know, you have to create the time. So, you know, people create time to do all kinds of things. They create time to meditate. They create time to have sex. They create time to eat, whatever. To me, you have to create time to think about how you're doing, to assess yourself. And sometimes, I usually do this more after a failure than a success. I like to look back.
Which is classic. Like that's true for any game,
yeah,
really.
Although it's good for success too, but successes are rarer, so I have more opportunities to do it when things fail. But you look back, and sometimes it could just be like something as basic as like, I had a falling out with a friend or something. And like, let me just think about like, what did I do? How did I communicate and with that person? And did I say something or do something that I may have perceived as, you know, benign or innocuous, and that person may have perceived as, you know, unkind or aggressive somehow.
So breaking that down, something bad happens. Do you assume, as an exercise, do you assume you did something wrong and then ask questions into that based on other examples of things being done wrong in relationships?
I probably do, but you've identified something that's an important question for anyone, which is, do you assume that you are in error? So I always—
Not assume, well, but at least throw it out there so you can have something to question.
Yeah. I mean, personally, and this is, I think, just a function of having grown up the way I did, I always assume that I'm in the wrong. I always assume that it was my error, which is not—
Because you're youngest of a bunch of brothers. And
it wasn't even that. It was just about being very religious. Like, you know, you basically, all you do all day is sin.
Yeah.
You know, which I'm not saying is...
And you were sinning in two religions.
I was. I didn't even know it. I didn't even know it. But no, I always assume, but I am getting less hard on myself as I get older. Maybe even to the detriment of good self-examination. Now I think I'm assuming more that when there are failures, like I know I'm not perfect, but man, those people really stink, you know.
So ask questions. What's another for self-examination?
Go back and read your emails. So I find that a lot. So email and whatever, however you communicate, you might text, you might email, you might whatever.
But this is not just social relationships.
Also in business and reporting and whatever. Like email, written communication is very two-dimensional. And you're missing all the inflection. You're missing humor. People make mistakes in writing and in reading. And I find that a lot of problems that I'm constantly encountering, like people failing to follow through or to do stuff or to get the idea, are the result of literally poor communication. So I try to look back at that. With something like golf, you know, we talked about this a little bit on Question of the Day. For me, I would say that 80% of my failures in golf are the result of our cognitive failures, of being either uptight or nervous or worrying about an outside perception rather than my inside production. And so once you have a big enough sample and you can look back at yourself and say, oh, this is the button that I keep pushing that is inhibiting me.
As opposed, so cognitive failures as opposed to
physical
holding the
failures.
Yeah, no, like,
here's the thing. Here's the thing about golf that I find interesting. I, as a golfer.
And by the way, I'm extrapolating this to business and other sports and other games, because I think a lot of it is, I think 80 to 90% is for any field that you want to excel at is going to be cognitive failures as opposed to the basic learning skills, which we could learn in like 10 minutes usually.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, obviously some things have physical degrees of difficulty that are high. Like, you know, if I have to hit a 98 mile an hour fastball, that's something that physically most humans just can't do, right? But that's where golf, again, you and I, before we started recording today, we're talking about why game playing is so awesome, because you can interact like with chess or backgammon or a board game. You can interact with anyone in any language, of any age, of any background, and that's awesome. But, you know, all games are different. One thing that's cool about golf, even though it is a stick and ball game, unlike baseball, like I am not going to be able to hit a 99 mile an hour fastball, probably ever. If I ever could have, even when I was young, I'm never, ever, ever going to do that. At least hit it far. Golf, though, is pretty weird in that even people who are really old and pretty weak and whatever, they can be pretty good golfers. It's a different kind of game. It's really you and the ball, and it's stationary. But here's the thing. I'm not a very good golfer. My handicap's a 12 for people who know what a handicap is. But even though I'm not very good, I am capable maybe 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 10 times of hitting a shot that is as good as a pro would hit. So that's unlike, you know, basketball or like I'm never going to dunk 0 out of 100, but 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 5, I can hit a shot that a pro would not be able to hit. Maybe, you know, a pro might hit it 7 out of 8 times. I might hit it 1 out of 8, but still it's the same shot. Mm. So physically I know that I'm capable. So why can't I do it more often? And that's where, so there are two answers. One is because consistency is a physical thing, and that's, you have to keep working at it. But two is because if you let your cognitive, if you get your, you know, alligator brain involved too much, which we almost always do in golf, because it's a stationary ball, you have all the time in the world to stand there and think, my butt must look funny. You know, I feel like my stance is pretty good, but if people are watching, I must look like I'm sticking my butt out. Like, what am I doing? And then like, oh, my arm kind of itches, and I wonder if I paid that bill. You know, all this crap that can happen, so that even though I'm physically capable, my cognitive overlord will create failure for me. But knowing that is the way to deal with it.
How do you – so knowing that's the first step, being aware that you have – there's cognitive failures, and that's the cause of not just golf, but maybe business failure, failure in other endeavors, failure in writing, whatever. How do you solve
Right. That's the million-dollar question. So, right. Okay. So I'm all about like the solutions. So, right. It's hard enough.
Tell me something I don't know about solving cognitive failures.
Well, I'll tell you something that I learned for me about solving the cognitive failure in golf. So this is very narrow, but obviously you have to look, every problem and every solution are case specific. That's one thing I really learned with a lot of work in Freakonomics, is that you can come up with you can say, you know, people respond to incentives, right? That's a baseline belief that I have, that I believe the evidence shows. But which incentive will work on which kind of people in which circumstance? It depends. It depends a lot. There are financial incentives and social incentives and moral incentives, and an incentive that might work well for most people for 6 months might wear off, et cetera, et cetera. So it's incredibly important to keep looking at the data, to keep being critical, to keep being, you know, analytical and so on. So for me, for golf, for this one tiny, 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 incredibly unimportant problem to everyone in the world but me, problem of getting my brain too involved, I thought, okay, so what can I do to decrease the possibility that my thinking is going to get in the way of my acting. And to me, I thought, well, close the window of thought. And what that means is when you play golf, you have basically everybody has a pre-shot routine. There are the certain things that you do ahead of every swing, which involve selecting the club that you're going to hit, thinking about the conditions, thinking about the shot, maybe practicing the swing and so on. And then you address the ball, you get up to the ball in your stance, and then you swing. So I found that I do all the pre-shot routine, whatever I want to do there, try to get some consistency. But I found that variances in that didn't seem to matter very much. The one variance that seemed to matter a lot is once I get up to the ball and stand over it in the kind of athletic swing, if I can decrease the time between getting over the ball and executing the swing from like 4 or 5 or 6 seconds to like 1 second, there's literally no time for my stupid brain to get involved with my slightly less stupid physicality.
It's funny.
And so that's my cheat.
Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ziprecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
It turns out, like, even when they study things like chess, that if you decrease the window of time to sitting down and making a chess move, it doesn't really change.
Really?
You might even make a better move, or it doesn't change the outcome that much. So it's an interesting theory that might apply to many things, that your gut actually might have a better answer than your prefrontal cortex, which does all this kind of, like, should I do this, should I do that type of thinking.
Right. I mean, that calls to mind, obviously, like what Malcolm Gladwell wrote about in Blink, the whole idea of, you know, fast decisions. It also calls to mind what they tell you when you're a kid taking tests to, you know, your first guess is, if it's a guess, if you don't really know, your first guess is more likely to be closer than a later one. But with chess, I would think that there are so many possibilities to run through.
But a strong player, their intuition will have run through.
Really? Them. Really? Yeah. Is that the case for you?
I only play blitz chess and like fast chess now. So I haven't even played slow chess in 20 years.
How different are your blitz moves than your slow moves?
It's hard to say now, but I would say for a 5-minute game, just as good as my slow moves.
Really?
Yeah, hardly ever different. Hmm. In fact, sometimes better because I'll be a little more reckless in fast chess and take more risks. And that sometimes if my intuition is backing the risk, thinking, oh, this seems like a good risk to take, that usually works out well for me.
Interesting.
But let's get down now to your new podcast. Tell me something I don't know. I'll describe it a little bit. You have a panel of 3 expert guests. Then you have an audience.
I would put expert in quotes.
I'll put expert in quotes, but they're kind of
they're
known.
They're kind of known, well-known people. Yeah.
You know, like a professor, a comedian, a doctor, mm-hmm. whatever.
Yep.
And then you'll have an audience of intelligent people, and they have professions that suggest that they might know something that the panel doesn't know.
Right.
And you'll select from the audience. They'll stand up and say, here's what I do. Here's something you don't know. The panel will ask questions about the thing they don't know, and then it's revealed what they don't know. And then at the end of the show, the panel votes on the biggest thing they didn't
right,
know.
Like they pick a winner. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm ambivalent about the gameplay part. So I like that it's a game.
Interesting because, I don't know, it might be different than what I thought. So that's
well, interesting. Well, it's fun. I mean, here's what I would ask.
Give me an example. Like, tell me something I don't know that came from the first episode of Tell Me Something I Don't Know.
Sure. So.
And I watched the show, so I have my own opinion.
You watched it or you listened to it?
Listen to it.
So let me see. I'm a little reluctant to totally give out. I'm a little reluctant to give out a quote answer because if people listen to this show before they listen to the first episode of Tell Me Something I Don't Know, they'll already know. But that's okay. I don't really care. It's a little bit of a spoiler. So for instance, here's one thing I liked. One of the what we call contestants is a guy, a medical doctor, medical researcher at the University of Toronto, a guy named Donald Rettelmeyer, whose research I've followed for years. It was really interesting, really quirky and interesting. And so his what we call IDK, his I don't know, had to do with the perils of voting. And the idea was, you know, I think the way he phrased the kind of riddle was, what's the most dangerous time to vote? But it wasn't really so much about time of day. It was
what's the dangerous time dangerous in terms of, like, there's more deaths or violent
injuries.
Yeah,
yeah. But really what he came to tell us was a very simple but very, useful fact to know, which is that the way that we do voting in the United States is dangerous in that about 28 people die every year on average on a presidential election day. 28 extra people.
He compared it to the Tuesday prior and the Tuesday after.
Right. So he's good with data. For medical research, he's very, very, very good with data. And so 28 people are dying, I should say, from traffic fatalities. And it's not just people who are driving to go vote. So the reason seems to be that there's a lot of unusual and a lot of extra auto traffic on election day. People, they might be rushing to vote. They might be rushing home. They might be driving someplace they're not used to driving. There are just more cars on the road. It's just an unusual traffic day. And 28 people each year die
more
as a result
New Year's
of that.
Day, I think he said.
The rate, I believe, is, I can't remember. I think New Year's Eve is still, yeah, I think he did say it used to be the most dangerous. So his point was that I have a bugaboo. It's a pet peeve of mine about traffic fatalities because it's one of these things that is, okay, relatively it's very safe. For the trillions of miles driven.
Because 28 is a small number compared to 100 million people voting.
Exactly.
So how do you know if that's statistically significant?
Well, because of the number of people who die every year. It's certainly, 28 more in any given day. There are 30,000 people roughly who die in the U.S. in a year from traffic fatalities. So divide that by 365, and 28 extra is quite a lot.
Yeah.
But my point is that 30,000 people die roughly every year from traffic fatalities in the U.S. And we kind of don't think about it anymore. It's kind of the cost of doing business. But I will guarantee you that I'll bet $100 that for every person listening to your show right now, every single one of them knows more people who have died or been grievously wounded in a traffic fatality than have died or been grievously wounded by, let's say, gun violence, which relatively, other than suicide, which is twice as common as homicide. But the fact is that this is something that is pretty dangerous, not on a per person, per lifetime level necessarily. And so he identified this in the data, which I found to be pretty cool. And the advice, the solution would be what? Well, maybe we have voting on more than one day, so it makes it easier for people to do it when it's more convenient. Maybe it's all online voting. Maybe it's all, a different form of voting.
So I love a piece of data like this. A, when he came on the show and asked, what's the most dangerous time of election day? It was sort of obvious to me, and even one of your panelists said, the end of the day. And then his explanation's reasoning was interesting, but I liked how he did the statistical analysis to prove this is really true. But does this strike you, because this almost seems like an interesting extension, a playful extension to the concept of Freakonomics. Like, does this strike you as a Freakonomics-ish type of datum?
That one certainly does. And there are others, like I think another one in the first episode that was I liked a lot was another doctor. We actually had three doctor contestants this one night, which was just a coincidence. But this other doctor who's a sleep researcher, he basically explained some new medical research that seems to answer the question of why we sleep, which I've always wondered. Like, don't you think it's weird, James, that there's 24 hours in a day and the human body goes totally dormant, unconscious, like almost dead for a third of it?
Well, we all know the health benefits of sleep. So
the benefits, yeah, but reasons.
But we don't know. But I guess when I was thinking about it, when I was listening to it, I was like, oh, is this, like, I just interviewed Arianna Huffington. She wrote all about sleep. So we know.
The renowned sleep scientist, Arianna Huffington.
Well, she talked to 1,000 sleep scientists. So we all know the benefits of sleep, but I guess I was thinking that we don't really know why there's these benefits. And his explanation was, in fact, fascinating.
So what I liked about his explanation, now I'll give the spoiler, is that it's not only about the need for the physical, you're right. We know a lot about that sleep correlates with a lot of outcomes, which are important outcomes. But the fascinating to me part of his explanation is the function, what's happening in the brain during sleep would seem to be a process that we hadn't thought about before. Okay, so what's happening in the brain that happens when we sleep, which is something that wasn't widely known until this recent
and
research.
And I did not know it until I listened to your podcast, Tell Me Something I Don't Know.
Oh, yeah, all right. Thank you for the plug. It's basically a process. And again, this is, I mean, it's good research. Who knows how valuable this will turn out to be. It's a process.
It's incredibly valuable, and I Googled it afterwards.
I would like to think it's valuable. It's basically, and this is what I love about this particular contestant, this thing, is that this was research designed to answer one question, and it produced a finding that could have huge ramifications for a totally different arena. It's kind of like, you know, thanks to NASA, theoretically, computing advanced a lot. I don't know how true that really is. I hear that a lot, whatever. But like, thanks to people trying to figure out why we sleep, there seems to be an advance in our understanding of a lot of other disease like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and so on, which is to say that when we sleep, our brain cells shrink and the corridors between them are flooded with spinal fluid that is meant to literally wash away accumulating proteins. I'm not a doctor, I'm not a scientist. I think I'm saying all that right.
That is what he
and those proteins that when they build up can cause, these cognitive difficulties like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and so on. So that was something I learned on Tell Me Something I Don't Know.
So what was great about this, these two things you mentioned, the 28 people who die on election day, if they are driving to the polls.
Oh, by the way, I should say, sorry, an important caveat. It may not be 28 voters. It could be some innocent kid that's walking down the street.
Basically, close to polling close time, don't drive don't go outside.
It's really election day. I mean, if you really wanted to stop it, you would say, hey, all mail-in ballots, which is, not very realistic and maybe not the right solution to the problem.
All what?
Mail-in ballots or, online ballots instead of, why should people physically have to on one given day?
Well, it should be online voting ultimately.
Yeah, or at least on a weekend when people are not.
But it's specifically the close of the election day when people are kind of rushing and so they're a little more stressed and tense.
And it's dark.
So these are two things. These are two facts that at first I thought going into this podcast, I'm going to learn some quirky, funny things that I could share in a cocktail party and get people to laugh. But then it turns out you told me.
Did we bum you out? Is that what you're saying?
No, you told me two things that actually could improve my life. Like be a little more careful towards the end of the polling day on, election day, particularly a major election day when everyone's voting. And
sleep like a mouse.
Make sure it's actually pretty serious to sleep like 8 hours a day, particularly if you have, like, let's say dementia or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's in the family.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I don't know if there's any other.
I should say though that even though so this is why I said earlier I'm ambivalent about the game show part. I love that it is a game show because it's really fun. It's fun to do. It's fun to be in the audience. But to me, the game show is like the Trojan horse, and what's inside the horse is like stuff you really want to know.
I disagree a little bit because I think people are incentivized to give you the most interesting, quirky, the other people don't know these things because they are in the game.
That's true. That's a very good point.
So the game show is kind of part of this completely. I will add, and I won't give away the spoiler on it, but then you have kind of this end segment where it's like a team-based play of, kind of topics. Tell me, they spin a wheel to come up with topics, and the team has to come up with something that the audience doesn't know. And there is something relating to vampires and how headstones are placed over
that was
graves.
That was pretty cool.
Which was interesting, and yeah. It wasn't quite Google fact-checked, although I tried, and there was some relevance there. But it was very interesting. But what else? Now, I haven't listened to – you have some other episodes in the can. I haven't listened to those. What else what's another – just tell me one more interesting fact that you've learned from Tell Me Something You Don't Know over these next several episodes that could help my life. I want my life to be better. That's the only reason I have anybody on my podcast. So make my life a little better.
All right. I'm going to look at a list here. So – we had, this won't make your life better other than be entertained. One of the founders of the Blue Man Group, Chris Wink, was a contestant on a show and talked to us about.
A contestant or a panelist?
A contestant. Because most of what we call contestants are actually extremely accomplished and well credentialed people, you know, it could be anyone, anyone who's got something cool. But it turns out that a lot of people who have something interesting to tell have something interesting to tell because they're very, very accomplished and interesting people. So he talked about colloids, which are a form of, you know, when you see Blue Man Group and you see all the stuff that they put in their mouths and swallow and spit out and so on. Anyway,
no, I don't know.
I'm not good at explaining that, but suffice it to say that if you like Blue Man Group or have seen it, then episode 3 you should see, because Chris Wink, one of the founders, talks about that. This was an episode called Things That Go in Your Mouth. So it was mostly about edible things or let me just find one. Like, I want to find something from our list of things that are – well, here's something that I think could help you or anyone. So there was this guy who presented. He was also from Toronto, I think, just coincidentally. He's an academic, but I can't remember his discipline. Maybe an engineering guy. And he talked about whether – about – as a college professor, whether it's a good idea to let students compare their grade to the average. And it's something I'd never really thought about before, and it didn't seem that interesting to me. But
it also seems very Freakonomics-ish. I like this.
Yeah, but everyone on the panel that night – so on the panel that night were a comedian, Keisha Zoller. I don't know if you know her. She's awesome. But also Austin Goolsbee, who's an economist who used to be the chief White House economist. And he's a really interesting, also pretty funny guy. And Angela Duckworth, who wrote Grit. So Austin and Angie are both college professors. So when this guy was talking about this notion of what happens if you don't tell students what the average is, they were fascinated with it and immediately took the conversation in a place where I would have never imagined. And so basically, his argument was that it's that most people want to know how they compare to the average, but that it's bad for almost everyone. And in retrospect, that doesn't sound like very interesting or weird, but...
But is it one of those things where it's because they know this extra information, they can start to game it?
I think it's less the concern that they'll game it and more the concern that they'll settle for less, that we basically all try to achieve a kind of mediocrity. Because his argument is that, like, you know, when you're a student or when you're learning anything in life, what's your goal? Is your goal to, like, be good enough to not be an outlier? Or is your goal to, like, actually learn so that when you go into practice that you'll actually be productive and good? And obviously, we know the answer, for most of us at least, is the latter. But the problem is that the way that the education system is set up, we tend to respond to the incentive that's surrounding the former.
So improve my life. Like, tell me how I can use this.
I think the single easiest way, as I understand it, and this conversation that took place in the show was much better than a conversation. You know, I wasn't involved in this conversation. That's why it was so good. It was basically like, you should not give a flying crap about how your effort and even your outcome when you're learning something, when you're training, compares to everybody else. Well, it's absolutely irrelevant. It's absolutely irrelevant. So you should worry much more. So here's the way I would translate it. Worry much, much, much more at all times about your absolute measure versus your relative measure. And that will also make you happier, by the way, because it's when people start to measure relatively in terms of, you know, income and good looking and all, that's when we get unhappy. Absolutely.
Well, it's interesting because I'm reading Bob Dylan's autobiography, Chronicles or whatever he calls it. And he says when he was first starting out, you know, he obviously was obsessed with folk music and playing and listening and performing. And he said many people would sing and you could tell they were trying to promote themselves the most. Like they were trying to belt out the song and show off their voice. And,
as opposed to the song?
And he would always forget about himself and just put all his energy into just performing the best possible song. Put the song first is what he said.
Right.
And it's the same kind of principle. And this is what he wrote
That's
30
really
or 40 years ago.
It's funny. I'm reading Bruce Springsteen's memoir.
How's that
right
book?
Now.
It looks good.
You know, I went through a period where I loved him. And I think you and I may have talked a little bit about, I actually got to meet him once when I was playing music, and he was weird.
Did you have
enough,
like a kind of a gay man crush on him once you met him?
Oh, yeah, of course. But he was weirdly enough, believe it or not, even though I really liked some of his music a whole lot, he was one of the reasons why I stopped playing music is because he when I met him, he had just become like huge. It was Born in the USA record, which was, you know, now is obviously a long time ago, but it was his first gigantic, where he went over from, he crossed over from being like, you know, a cool rock and roll guy to like being a pop star. And he didn't like it. And like, it was causing problems for in his life. And it wasn't like I had some big profound conversation with him. I was more like a witness to this conversation. But it made me realize that, man, you know, that goal that everyone goes for, like being famous, that's maybe that's the wrong goal, you know? And so he was very influential to me in my life, even though he didn't know it, of course. But the last like 20 years of music he's made, 25 years, I haven't liked very much, just the way it goes. And so I was really excited to like connect with him in this book, and which describes obviously his whole career. And it's funny because like he's a good songwriter. He's obviously a really, really, really good songwriter. But reading it, especially in light of the news of Dylan getting the Nobel in literature, which is its own kind of weirdness, like, I hate to say it, he's just no Bob Dylan. He's just not. Like, as awesome as Bruce Springsteen is, if you like, look, this is totally subjective, but if you like, you know, creativity and artistry and like originality, it's an order of magnitude difference. That's what I'm saying.
Do you think on the day that the Nobel Prize was announced with Bob Dylan, obviously a lot of writers were thinking, why did I want to be picked? Why did
all those writers, I say, you know.
Yes, I agree with you. But do you think, until you said this about Bruce Springsteen, do you think all of a sudden all these songwriters woke up, like Elton John, Bruce Springsteen, whoever, and said, why they pick him? Why did they pick me?
No, that's not what they thought. They thought, oh, if they're going to give it to someone, obviously it's Dylan. And then they thought, oh, shit, they're not going to give it to another musician for another 100 years. Huh. That's what they thought.
That's interesting.
That's like the way every economist, like if I'm an economist and I do game theory and I'm only 50 years old, which is relatively young for the Nobel, and then 2 70-year-olds get it for game theory, I think, they're not going to give another game theory prize for a long time. I hope I'm still alive then, because it's only for the living.
So another question I have about Tell Me Something I Don't Know. Like, again, the average podcast is like you and me sitting here talking. It's relatively easy to put together and so on. And there's various levels of production quality. Like, I'll have an editor go over this, and you and I have known each other for a long time, and whatever. I'll do my extra things to make this good. And I listen to your episodes and prepared. But this was another level of production quality and work to do Tell Me Something I Don't Know. It's really like the setup for a TV show. You had to find guests. You had to find a location to get an audience and guests together. You had to be somewhat scripted. Like you said, you picked out of 1 out of 30 audience members to present their thing. Then you had this another segment, the Wheel of Danger. Then you have to edit it. And then you have to prepare. With each episode, you had a different set of 3 panelists, yeah, a different audience. This is hard work, like for a podcast, which is still a developing medium. It's one thing if it's going on ABC and you're going to have millions of listeners on day one, but this is a developing medium.
The question is, are you crazy?
Yeah, I think that is the question. Like, how much work was this, and does it feel like it's worth it?
So short answer is it was a blast. But yeah, it's a lot of work. We have to cast for panelists.
How many people for the panelists? How many people do you ask versus how many people say yes?
So I'm probably not the best person to ask, because I do have a production team that they actually did most of the hard work on.
So I know your production team, and they asked me for quite a bit of contact info of different people.
Yeah.
And none of them said yes, yeah, apparently.
We probably asked, probably overall for every one panelist we got, we probably asked for somewhere between 5 and 10, a lot of people wanted to do it, even very famous, you know, we have some fairly well-known people, a lot of very well-known people want to do it. Part of the issue of casting this, unlike casting, let's say, Freakonomics Radio, if someone wants to do it, we say, great, when do you want to do it? And we find a time to record. This is a live show. So we have to have three panelists, a bunch of contestants, and a couple hundred people in the audience.
Couple hundred?
In the audience.
How many people were in the audience?
You know, I think the place where we recorded the first season, 180, something like that. But that's just, you know, that's audience. That's not, yeah, so not everyone in the audience is a potential contestant. There's just a handful that we kind of already know who will be there. So, yeah, but yeah, we have, it's, so we're doing a couple things that we're producing a live event.
Hundreds of people show up in the audience.
You know, you tweet and you, I don't know, but I think we were close to sold out. I think our first six that we taped in September that are now being released starting now. And now we're taping another season of 10 episodes starting quite soon, December and January.
How come I haven't been asked?
You're going to be a panelist. We're also going to do it out of town. We're going to try to do it in, I think we're going to start fairly locally, try to do a couple shows in Washington and Boston.
You should do Las Vegas too.
Vegas would be really good.
But you can get like you had Annie Duke on one of the episodes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you can get like really good gamblers are good at like, you know, assessing the odds of every situation. So you can get really good gamblers of like, you know, poker, backgammon.
I also love the former mayor, Oscar Goodman. He'd be really good. I don't know if you know him. He was a mob lawyer who became mayor of Las Vegas. And now his wife, he got term limited. And now his wife is the mayor. She'd probably be good too. I don't know
her.
She's
like the Ava Perón of Las Vegas.
I guess that's true. In answer to your question, it is a lot of work. That said, it was hugely fun. That said, also, for me, who's used to doing a lot of journalism, not in real time, not in front of a live audience and so on, I like it. I'm not a ham really, but I really enjoy the live format. I love interacting with the panelists. Here's my favorite thing. I love that we're basically turning journalism or podcasting, whatever you want to call it, upside down, where rather than having us, the people in quote power or authority, like, have a piece of trivia and then we make you have to guess it. It's the opposite. We're saying to the world or to the audience,
tell me something I don't know.
Tell me something I don't know. Anyone is eligible. You can do this, you know, someday I'd like to think that we'll be playing this game in schools with kids, in refugee camps with people trying to figure out how to make your way in a new world. You know, I really think it's the instinct of this.
Someone can easily make a game, like a board game on this.
Yeah, board game, you know, maybe. I mean,
An app?
I mean, I don't really care that much about like the business expansion part. That's not like what excites me. But I do like the idea. I love the idea of like unleashing this show in a way that makes just people generally who listen to it think, oh yeah, I should more often, like, you know, I've got a 94-year-old grandmother and I've never really talked to her much. So the next time I go see her, I'll say, hey grandma, tell me something I don't know about growing up in the 1930s.
I think that tell me something I don't know is an excellent way to kind of start interesting conversation as opposed to how's the weather type of conversation. So it's a good way to avoid
although
small
it's
talk.
Interesting. I think in one of the very first, maybe the very first Question of the Day episode we ever recorded, one of the first, I think something similar came up where it was like, how do you start a conversation? I remember what you said. You said, where are you from? And I thought, really? You're going to, that's your best answer, James? And then we talked about it for a while and I realized you were totally right. So if you say that tell me something I don't know is your new where are you from, then I'm sure you're right.
It's very hard for me to like start conversations, so I'm going to use this technique. This also improved my life. Now, one final thing I'll ask. It seems like you're really exemplifying kind of the reinvention that's happening all across society, in the sense that you've gone from musician to journalism to sort of memoir writer, to Freakonomics writer, where you wrote four Freakonomics books, to Freakonomics radio. Then we tried a slightly easier format with Question of the Day. Now you're in a much more complicated format that I've never seen in the podcasting world before with Tell Me Something I Don't Know. What are you learning about this process of reinvention? Like, what? Tell me something I don't know about you that you've learned through this process of reinvention.
So this has been a long and painful learning process, but for me, the most important, strength or the most important position Now, neither of those words are right. But to me, the most important change in approaching all this as a, quote, creative person, I don't think of myself as like a, whatever, artist, but you know.
You are, though.
Yeah. But here's the thing. Makers make and managers manage, and never the twain shall meet. And I hate to sound that black and white about it, but if you have an idea about a business, a product, a piece of media, music, recipes, whatever, there will inevitably probably be the need for some collaboration with some kind of company or distributor or whatever. But you know what? Even if they're the most wonderful people on the planet, and I've dealt with some wonderful partners, they're not you. They don't think like you. They don't care about the same things that you think about. And the only person at the end of the day, the only one who really cares about how the thing that you are making comes out is you.
But it's not that what they're doing is less important. They could be very proud of how they manage putting it together.
Yeah, this is not against them. I'm not saying that you're superior. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that you are you. And I'm not saying that someone who's maybe involved in the marketing or the distribution or the manufacturing of your thing doesn't add a lot. They often, obviously they do. But at the end of the day, you have to remember that if you want something done in a way that represents you, your spirit, your soul, your work, I mean, you're right. This thing cost a lot of money and a lot of time. I had to start a company to do it, and it may be a total failure, although so far the indications are good. I mean, if you look, I mean, the iTunes charts would seem to suggest so far that early on that it's going to do well. I have no idea. But you know what? Even if it totally fails, I'll feel pretty good about it because we created something kind of out of whole cloth. And even though it may not be awesome right out of the gate, I think it's pretty good out of the gate. I think it'll get better. And I think people will like it. And that's like a good feeling, as opposed to like begging some media company to let me make something that they're willing to fund. And the thing that I'll make might be okay with me, but quite possibly might be something that kind of sets my teeth off a little bit, and I just don't want to do that.
This reminds me of a quote from Jerry Seinfeld. He was on Howard Stern, and Howard Stern was saying, "Jerry, the entire world was begging for you to do another season of Seinfeld. You know, even GE was offering you, you know, $100 million right up front to do another season of Seinfeld, and you said no. How come, you know, if 300 million people wanted you to do another season, why didn't you do it?" And Jerry Seinfeld said, "Well, that's why I created the most successful TV series ever, and those people didn't.
Right.
Like, I know when to stop."
Right.
So, well, congratulations on the launch of this episode. This new podcast. The episode I listened to was excellent, and it did make my life better. So I hope each one does the same, and I highly encourage everyone to listen to it. And once again, Stephen Dubner, very good friend of the James Altucher Show. Come back on the next time you create something.
I will. And now it's time for some backgammon.
Yes. Yes. So I think you're going to win this match too. This particular sub-match of the more bigger global match, which I will point out, I am winning.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hey, thanks for listening. Listen, I have a big favor to ask you, and it will only take 30 seconds or less, and it would mean a huge amount to me. If you like this podcast, please let me know. Please let the team I work with know. Please let my guests know, and you can do this easily by subscribing to the podcast. It's probably the biggest favor you could do for me right now, and it's really simple. Just go to iTunes, search for The James Altucher Show, and click subscribe. Again, it will only take you 30 seconds or less, and if you subscribe now, it will really help me out a lot. Thanks again.